On this week's program, David Patrick Stearns looks ahead to this evening's nationally simulcast Philadelphia Orchestra concert featuring the superstar Chinese pianist Long Long. Susan Lewis takes us to Here, a new exhibition at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, exploring the sense of place in the work of artists from six different U.S. regions. And we speak with the Philadelphia-based contemporary artist Tristan Lowe. His Under the Influence, an installation comprised of two interconnected works, is on view at the Philadelphia Museum of Art from today. That's all ahead this morning on Creatively Speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Philadelphia a star and came back an even bigger star, and when he leaves the city next week he might be, if it were possible, even more celebrated. The Chinese pianist Long Long, who was one of Gary Graffman's star pupils at the Curtis Institute of Music, has achieved something approaching rock star status in his native China, but tonight from the Kimmel Center makes his first cinema cast when his performance with the Philadelphia Orchestra is beamed to some 500 theaters across the country. It's a big deal for an orchestra that's emerging from bankruptcy, even if the Philadelphians will only be featured in one part of tonight's concert. The star of the show is Long Long, whose record company Sony Classical is bankrolling the affair to the tune of several hundred thousand dollars. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns spent a few hours backstage with Long Long this week and found the pianist as ebullient as ever.
We're here in Verizon Hall while Long Long is trying to decide between the two pianos owned by the Kimmel Center.
To see Long Long at the piano is to see him whole. He's been a pianist as far back as he can remember. With characteristic expansiveness, he decided that he wanted both instruments, one for Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 2 that he played yesterday afternoon, and one for Liszt's Piano Concerto No. 1 that he'll play tonight. Into his dressing room swept Charles Dutoit for a five-minute rehearsal.
Oh, maestro!
Oh, my God.
Dutoit is fast and efficient, and Long Long wasn't about to argue with any conductor who has worked so much with one of his favorite pianists, Martha Argerich.
That's certainly the fastest I ever had in my life. What is, are you going to, her maestro should do this? I mean, come on, this is Martha Argerich. What do you want? and this is two of the concertos she always played with him.
Looking out his dressing room window, Long Long points to the high-rise building where he lived as a student in the late 1990s, watching the Kimmel Center being built brick by brick. His mom, dad, and full-size Steinway grand made for crowded quarters. But that didn't stop his mom from making grand Chinese feasts.
It was very crowded. That was a nice time. You know, my mom's such a good cook, you know, and I'm still happy now. I mean,
Long Long is approaching his 30th birthday, but you'd never know it to look at him.
You know, I must admit, when I was a teenager, I look much older than today. If I don't have a tie, let's say, maybe they will think that I'm not serious enough.
There's little time for sentimental journeys in his Philadelphia homecoming. He had planned to come here to play a regular Philadelphia concert that happened to fall on Franz Liszt's birthday, which is today. Then in April, Sony Classical and NCM Fathom, the company that carries the Metropolitan Opera simulcast in movie theaters around the globe, started looking into the possibility of doing a cinema cast here. The Philadelphia Orchestra was hardly an unknown commodity to NCM Fathom, according to the orchestra's general manager, Steve Millen.
We had conversations with NCM Fathom as long ago as 2008 about possibly doing a broadcast series with the Philadelphia Orchestra. There was great interest by both parties. We just couldn't figure out the right relationship for where we were in our respective timelines.
As always, Long Long himself is on a tight timeline. Having performed in Japan on Sunday, he was in New York on Monday to promote his new album, and on Tuesday went to Washington, D.C., where he did a public service video for his favorite charity, the World Wildlife Fund. Long Long recently signed on to the film soundtrack to the movie My Week with Marilyn about Marilyn Monroe. He recently played piano for Champion Ice Skaters. During the Shanghai Expo, he was seen performing with dancing girls on stage. Where, when, and how does he say no?
If you get a phone call from Hollywood saying that, oh, this is a film, and we'd like you to do it, but we don't even know who's the composer, the answer should be no. Because what about if there's something, the quality of the music is really bad? The movie can be a blockbuster, but that's destroy your art.
The Marilyn composer is Alexander Michael Desplat. The two previously worked together on the 2007 film The Painted Veil. Yet the classical part of Long Long's life is actually getting more serious. This year's recital programming includes Schubert's expansive, deeply existential sonata in B-flat. But seriousness has to be scheduled into a life as complicated as his. He's been dying to get back to Bach's Goldberg Variations and finally found a slot, 2014 in Salzburg. Long Long also knows he could lose it all with a piano injury. His Curtis Institute teacher, Gary Grafman, had a brilliant career until he lost the use of his right hand. The great pianist Murray Pariah has had on-again, off-again injuries for something like 20 years. Long Long, who has always managed his money carefully, dating back to the years when he took the Chinatown bus home from his New York concerts, has a backup. He always does.
Yeah, buy very good insurance. I mean, I'm joking, but it's true. You know, just be careful. Don't burn yourself. Don't play too much or practice too much. Or it's hard, but you need to be aware, even though it's hard to balance. But always don't burn yourself. Not worth it.
Longtime Long Long watchers may be interested to know that his dad, often painted as the slave driver behind the career, is back in China devising and presenting concerts for his son. Keeping such matters in the family is a very Chinese thing to do. Long Long says that an incident he recounted in his autobiography when his father ordered him to commit suicide after failing an audition is a now-forgotten crisis. Currently, Long Long travels with his mother, from whom he was separated during his student years in Beijing and early years at Curtis. She's a moderating influence.
Yeah, she sometimes interrupts some of my lunch meetings, and she said, go eat first and then meet. And I think she's all right. She wants me to be on the ground, you know, never look down at people and always, you know, sincere to people. Sometimes if you travel so much, you know, and you become kind of light, you know, you become very selfish. You know, and she's the one, the person who keep myself very solid and to know exactly where I am.
Long Long has left people behind along the way. For years, he was devoted to his mentor, Daniel Barenboim, not so much now. He often collaborated with composer Tan Dun, maybe not in the future. Such things happen among busy people with strong personalities. And how is his playing? His E-Day fix these days is Liszt, a composer who doesn't bring out Long Long's more tasteful side. And in a way, Long Long plays into the hands of his critics, the ones who have called him Bang Bang, by beginning his new album with flashy encores. Understanding Long Long more fully, however, requires something of a Chinese perspective, part of which is a mentality that says, if you're not number one, you're nowhere. And Long Long's brand of exuberance is nothing compared to what one hears from young musicians in China who weren't so lucky to get into the Curtis Institute. I've perused the gift shops in the concert halls of Beijing, and among the local artists, you find recordings that are nothing but encores. In a way, Long Long is a beacon of integrity in his homeland, and not just because he goes beyond encores. Parts of the Liszt Concerto on Thursday night with the Philadelphia Orchestra have the sensitivity of a Chopin nocturne. That's the Long Long that the public first loved, and that part of his personality has not diminished one bit.
Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. This evening at the Kimmel Center, Long Long is the soloist for a nationally simulcast concert with the Philadelphia Orchestra. The program features works by Liszt and Shostakovich.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
While today much is made of the globalization and homogenization of everything from commerce and jobs to political systems and the arts, regionalism and the strengthening of regional identities may be on the rebound, at least in the world of fine art. The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts in Philadelphia is exploring the impact of place on the creation of art with an exhibition that brings together the work of artists from six different regions in the United States. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis considers the show, titled simply, Here.
Although New York may be the center of the contemporary art market, artists live everywhere. Curator of contemporary art at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, Julian Rubson, born in Scotland, lived in England and Austria before landing in Louisville, Kentucky for 8 years.
And every time I went to New York and I was introduced to people in galleries, there would always be someone who said, "Oh, you're from Louisville, Kentucky, right, I bet you're glad to get up here," as if I lived on some kind of periphery out in the sticks.
Rubson's experience in Louisville didn't feel to him like living in a periphery. He found a thriving young art community that was very connected, through the web, to international art discussions. Rubson began wondering about the influence of the environment on contemporary art.
I was interested how artists who actually live in other places, even artists in New York, that what they produce is saturated with their experience of where they are. And I wanted to create a show that looked away from the big market center, because there are other things than the market. Also, I didn't want to go and use all those places that are kind of the secondary market centers, I guess, in the country, like LA and Chicago and Houston and Miami and so on, all those cities that belong to that sort of circuit, but rather to look at other places.
Those other places turned out to be Cincinnati, Phoenix, Scottsdale, Raleigh-Durham, Detroit, Kansas City, Missouri, and Philadelphia, now Robson's home. He chose a curator in each region to pick local artists. Artist Tim Portlock, originally from Chicago, lived in London and New York before arriving in Philadelphia 5 years ago.
One of the first things that struck me when I moved here was the volume of abandoned and dilapidated buildings.
Taking photographs of these empty buildings as reference material, Portlock then used 3D modeling, special effects, and computer gaming software to create fictionalized images of the city that are also informed by the conventions of American landscape painting, particularly, says Portlock, the Hudson River Valley School.
It was the first American art movement. They were very conscious of constructing an American identity and projecting that to the rest of the world. One of the hallmarks, at least they felt, of American identity was this wild, untamed landscape. And so my work shows an American landscape that's been industrialized, and now the industrialization is being reversed.
To those who know Center City, Philadelphia, Portlock's large 5x6 feet images may seem familiar, and yet not. One, for example, shows City Hall topped by a human figure that looks more like Leonardo da Vinci's classic model of man than a colonial William Penn. Surrounding City Hall are abandoned buildings of the sort found in parts of West and North Philadelphia. This is the city reordered and rearranged. In several works, sneakers hang from telephone wires and wild dogs roam the streets.
The dogs, for me, represent sort of a social presence, a living social presence in the space. Also, it's pretty consistent with the conventions of 19th century American landscape painting, where you depict the flora and the fauna.
In contrast with the desolation, the sky is swept with the striking reds and oranges of the sun.
A lot of 19th century American landscape painters wanted to depict the American landscape as a sublime experience. And I kind of think of it as an ironic a component of my images.
Portlock is one of 24 artists in the exhibition, which includes a range of work, including drawing, painting, printmaking, sculpture, video installations, and performance art, or documentation of it.
We're excited tonight to present to you some of your favorite performers.
When they co-host Whoop-Dee-Doo, a variety show that works with underserved youth in Kansas City, Missouri, Matt Roach wears a werewolf costume and Jamie Warren gets decked out like a bag of popcorn. In this exhibition, Whoop-Dee-Doo is represented in videos within an environment built using paint, paper, cardboard, and plastic sheets, designed to give the playful feeling of the show, which is an eclectic mix.
Kind of structured like a faux public access television show. And we have community performers on the show and skits and contests and games and wild installations, and community performers collaborate together on the show to make unique pieces.
Using a theme for each live show, Whoop-Dee-Doo builds an environment for a variety of creative expressions and sometimes takes its act on the road. A show in Portland, Oregon explored the body, creating rooms for different internal organs, one for the brain, one for the belly.
And you crawl into the belly button and you get to hang out in there and you watch a video. And then you walk off to the back corner and there's a giant intestinal maze. And you walk into a mouth and walk through the esophagus and walk through the intestines. And so that's what we're trying to do, is create this environment where we can bring anyone into it and they can find a place to present something. Either it's in the performance of the show, or it's in building the more conventional part of the set, the stage, or it's in making these sort of side installation areas.
The show deliberately seeks a diverse mix of artists and performers who wouldn't ordinarily work together, as in a show in Kansas City where they paired a group of middle-aged women dancing in clogs with a drag performer. And how does its location in Kansas City, Missouri, affect the art of Whoop-Dee-Doo? Warren talks of the support from other artists in the community for this kind of collaborative and unpredictable performance art.
It doesn't feel at all competitive. In fact, exactly the opposite. It's like, everybody wants to help you. Everyone wants each other to succeed because everyone wants Kansas City to have a bigger name for itself one day.
However varied the art is in this show, there are commonalities to be found, such as the social commitment, even a yearning that comes through work as different as that of Whoop-Dee-Doo and Tim Portlock.
Thinking about American identity, how our identity, like American identity, was very much wrapped up in being an industrialized country and that we made things. And obviously, the idea of being a country that makes things has changed. Yeah, but our identity is, I think, to some extent in crisis because of this. So, like, what do we do now? Or who are we now?
If there is a purpose to the project that could be summed up, I feel that our goal is to help, I guess, fight isolation, fight loneliness.
Other artists include Chito Johnson, a white man born in Zimbabwe, whose work reflects the comfort zone he's found in Detroit's sense of otherness. Abigail Ann Newbold, who moved from Detroit to Boston, has constructed an installation reflecting ideas of temporariness. Gregory Sale explores aspects of the prison system in Arizona. A collective from North Carolina has a cabinet of curiosities that they'll tow around on a bicycle opening night, engaging people on Lenfest Plaza and in Love Park. The goal of the exhibition, says curator Julian Rubson, is to get a conversation going.
In terms of regionalism, it's saying, is it possible for us to reopen this discussion and to start to think about how, in fact, there is this kind of multi-centered possibility of looking at work and thinking about how artists' works relate to each other. In a way, it's not positing a notion of what regionalism is, but rather saying, well, there's a discussion here that needs to be opened up and we need to start looking at it.
In the 20th century, artists gathered first in Paris, then later in New York, to be part of a dynamic art scene and to be able to sell their work. And describing art as regional often implied a certain parochial or unsophisticated quality or character. Today, while globalization has led to much homogenization, it can also lead, ironically, to the strengthening of regional pride and the celebration of differences. With global communication and the internet facilitating international art conversations among artists, curators, collectors, and others, artists can work in their own backyards connected to the world, yet informed by the richness of their individual regions.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The exhibition Here opens today at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts in Philadelphia and runs through December 31st. So our next item takes us out of the studio and into the Perelman Building at the Philadelphia Museum of Art to view a work by a Boston-born, Philadelphia-based artist, Tristan Lowe. The work is called Under the Influence, and it's in the form of two installations interconnected by another part of the art. Maybe you should explain exactly what it looks like and why it looks this way. What are we looking at here? Right, this is like a comet, right?
Yeah, outside we have a comet. And this one's called Nature. Comet as Nature. This sort of introduces you into the space. Inside we have the moon, right, which has over half a billion craters on it. Not the one in there, but the real one. And all those impacts were made by comets and meteors and stuff like that. So we have a neon red comet that's basically sort of like a 3D drawing, probably about 8 or 9 feet up, so you can walk right under it.
So that's the first thing we see is this red neon comet. Then we approach what can only be described as either an Alice in Wonderland or a Jonathan Swiftian type door. This door is here to make us feel small.
I don't know about to make you feel small, but to make you feel maybe like a kid again a little bit, and to make you realize like how a door functions. It really does bring you into another space, and to make this a really otherworldly kind of space.
And we're also moving from the light into the dark.
Yeah. And so in here we have, literally, we're stepping into another space, into space.
And it's really dark. One side of the room is dark, and the other side of the room is blue lit, right?
Yeah, the dark's the far side of the moon is blue. But yeah, it creates a nice night sky, if you will, blue, a nice dusk or so. And then here we have the moon, which is rendered in felt. It's done all these craters sort of tweezed into the felt. Kind of crazy labor-intensive process.
Well, particularly when we know of your history a little bit, that you've worked in other less sophisticated materials, chocolate, butter, found materials. There's a great deal of craft involved in this. How much of this is your handiwork? I mean, the neon, the door,
I don't bend the glass.
Brass door lock.
Those are all mine. Wow. I raise the metal. Yeah. I mean, I like all the different, all material speaks in a different way, kind of. So I think there's attributes
but
that
you have
I
to know its language, clearly, in the first place. How did you go
get your
about,
hands
I'm going
in
to
there.
Make you, I'm going to make...
What, a keyhole?
Well, not a keyhole. You're making an entire lock, right? Or at least the impression key, of a lock.
Yes, I don't have the mechanism. I didn't finish it. But the other parts of it, for all intents and purposes, are separate parts and everything. Yeah, the doorknob. I did metal work a little bit, you know, steel work in school. And I still love that material. So it's great. You know, I have a welder and TIG welder and grinders and things like that.
The machines, not the people.
Yeah, not the people.
And then why choose felt for the moon? Because it works remarkably well. Clearly, not many of us have been to the moon, but this is what it would, not made of cheese at all, made of felt. That's the new headline, isn't it?
Actually, the moon kind of stems from this other piece I did, this big whale. I did this full-size whale, a 52-foot-long sperm whale. It's not here. It's at the Virginia Museum. But Moby Dick was based on a real whale called Mocha Dick. And he was described in 1839 in a Knickerbocker magazine as being white as wool and a head encrusted in barnacles. And in a weird way, working out the surface of the whale, because he's so huge, at times it was like, so it was really important to sort of get enough detail and stuff into the surface that you weren't just looking at a big blank sheet of felt. So the barnacles and the stitching and stuff, that sort of led to like a topographical look, like at times. And that sort of landscape that started to get on there made me start thinking about the moon and the craters. And I think there's over a half a million or a half a billion craters. I mean, that's the amazing thing, is that the moon is this great map of everything that's happened to it.
So tell me about the experience, though, of walking from the daylit, comet-laden sky through this childlike door into this impression of the moon, I guess as seen from space rather than from Earth. Is there a narrative to this?
I think that, well, the moon and the under-the-influence aspect is just how the moon
lunacy,
is...
Lunacy, right.
Yeah, lunacy, but also the moon, the days of the week, the months... All this stuff has been based on the cycles of the moon, and then there's, you know, the lunacy aspect, but also, like, I think actually the Hebrew calendar works off of the moon, and, like, we all have this kind of intimate experience with the moon, yet we have never been near it or anything, but we all have this sort of, you know, it's, I mean, there's a little bit of that surrealistic, I guess, aspect to it.
It's a very evocative experience going through the... I guess, exhibition, the installation, the work. What do you Do you hope people are going to have a mood change as they experience it?
I hope they have a... I want them to have an encounter that they wouldn't otherwise have, basically. I don't know what that is, and I don't want to dictate what that is. I think we all kind of come to... You know, like I said, with the moon, it's a funny thing. It's like you can... A kid can draw a crescent in the top corner of his paper, and everybody knows it's the moon. So we all do, and this is maybe more to the size of maybe the Little Prince's moon, you know, B612 or whatever, but it's still...
It's like, an imposing piece as well. About 15 feet
I feel
feet
like it's
tall?
A real... No, it's only 12 and a half feet tall, but it's about 40 feet around.
Can I ask you then, without wishing to define what we should experience in encountering this, every concept... Is it fair to say that every artistic concept looks better when it's rendered?
I don't know about that.
Okay, let me ask you more personally. Is every artistic concept of yours better when it's rendered?
I don't know if I can say that either. I mean, I can't... I did something honoring or something like the moon, like this connection, right? But in no way does it get to a greater experience than really walking out and seeing the moon every night.
Okay, you know, does it do to you what you hoped it would?
Yeah, I think, and it showed me other things that I didn't know that weren't gonna happen. Like the introducing visitor into it really created an atmosphere and a space. I mean, that's what we're in a way trying to drop out the white walls of the gallery and just have you have a more of a relationship one to one with the objects. So that the space kind of goes away and you're in space in a way. So just trying to set up a context and a place that you wouldn't otherwise be able to be.
Well, we appreciate it. Tristan Lowe, Under the Influence, is at the Spain Gallery at the Perelman Building of the Philadelphia Museum of Art from today. And that's our program for this week. You can hear an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony NC under music director Rossin Milanoff. The program's associate producer is Eric Brannan. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.